Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this Silicon Valley Reads 2012 event presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, Santa Clara County Library, San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Jane Light, Library Director for the City of San Jose, and one of three co-chairs for Silicon Valley Reads. It's my pleasure to introduce the outstanding panelists that we brought here tonight to discuss the topic, What's It Like to Be the Muslim Next Door in Silicon Valley? And as they come up and join me here, I will tell you a little bit about each of them. Sambal Ali Karamali grew up in Southern California, and she received her undergraduate degree from Stanford University and her law degree from UC Davis. She practiced corporate law in San Francisco and later moved to England, where she began her formal study of Islam at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies. After earning her Master's of Law degree, Sambal remained in London, where she worked at the University and the Center for Islamic and Middle Eastern Law. Sambal serves on the Board of Trustees of a nonprofit education institution that teaches multicultural education and environmental education to children and is on the steering committee of Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality. She was also awarded Santa Clara County's Asian American Hero Award for her work in fostering cross-cultural understanding and education. Sambal is the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing. Mohammed Chaudhry is president and CEO for the Silicon Valley Education Foundation. And that foundation is focused on helping prepare every student in Silicon Valley for completion of post-secondary education. The foundation is currently working to significantly increase the number of students completing Algebra 1 and 2 as gateway subjects to educational success. Mohammed is a board member of the California Department of Education, the California Consortium of Education Foundation, Partners in School Innovation, and the Hispanic Foundation Silicon Valley. He's on the advisory board of Silicon Valley Reads and an active member of the San Jose Rotary Club. He also serves as vice president of MKA USA, which is a youth development organization. Mohammed holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration from San Jose State and is a graduate of the Stanford Executive Leadership Program. Ronnie Amosin is a native of the Bay Area and joined the City's Association of Santa Clara County as its executive director in September 2009. In her current role, she works with elected officials from across the county to address issues of mutual concern, promote cooperation among the cities, and advocate for the 15 cities in our county. Before working with the City's Association, she worked with Senator Elaine Alquist for 4 years as a senior district representative and represented the senator on health issues and planned and managed major events and outreach programs, and also participated on advisory committees as a policy liaison for several organizations, including the American Cancer Society's Colon Cancer Free Zone and Community Health Partnership. She is active in her community and volunteers regularly at her children's school. She received both her Bachelor's of Science and MBA degrees from Santa Clara University. Barbara Marshman grew up on a farm near Boyertown, Pennsylvania, and graduated from Westchester State University. She spent the first half of her journalism career as a reporter and then an editor at a small-town newspaper in the Philadelphia area. Then, in 1987, she won a John S. Knight Fellowship to spend a year at Stanford University, and she never went back. She has been with the San Jose Mercury News since 1988 and became editor of the editorial pages in 2007. You can follow her on Twitter at Barb Marshman. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our panel and its moderator.
Thank you all. It's wonderful to see this crowd here on a weeknight in downtown San Jose. It's just marvelous. I'm delighted to be here. Silicon Valley Reads is a wonderful program, and this year it has really outdone itself. These are wonderful books, and it's such a timely and fascinating topic. And I'm delighted to be here with this wonderful panel. I thought we should start out just by, on the theme of being the Muslim next door, how did your lives change after September 11th. Not the day, because we've all been through the day so much, but over the past decade, what's different about being the Muslim next door since that happened? Would you like to start, Anya?
Sure. So apart from, I think, all of our reactions about the horrific events, I think what saddened me was that there were already misconceptions and stereotypes about Muslims in America, and you know, how it is that we're going to be able to kind of break these barriers, these higher barriers. So it was, I kind of felt that, you know, I was more on the defense as a Muslim here, and you know, I did feel a little bit scared at first, but you know, as as the days continued, you know, my day-to-day life did not change much. My children were young at that time, and I just realized that, you know, I had to continue living my life as a Muslim in America and do my part and try to educate, you know, my friends and the networks that I was involved in. I felt compelled to volunteer more at my children's schools. Mm-hmm. When teachers invited parents to come and speak, you know, about the traditions, I was there, along with others who talked about, you know, Diwali and Hanukkah. You know, I made an effort to do that, and I also mm-hmm. felt that it was important to do my part and show that, you know, as Muslims, we do contribute to our society, and you know, try to show that, you know, Islam is really about tolerance and peace and not this, not these stereotypes, you know, that Muslims are terrorists, and that these terrorists are in fact not Muslims. So.
Thanks. Simbul, you obviously things changed because they inspired you to write a book.
Well, actually I this is kind of embarrassing, but I started writing the book long before 9/11.
Really?
It just took me a while. And, you know, in a way, I feel like 9/11 didn't change things as much as people assume that it changed things, because I actually think that the Iranian Revolution in 1979 is what changed the landscape when it came to Islam much more dramatically. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I grew up in L.A., which is my excuse for a lot of things. And
Sorry.
I know. But... anyway, so I was a kid before the Iranian Revolution, and you know, I was often the only Muslim that people around me knew. So it was just this little window where most first generation American born Muslims were just like 2 or 3 years younger than I was. My dad came early because he was a mathematician, and they needed to bolster up the space program and get to the moon before the Russians. So I answered a lot of questions, and the reaction I got before 1979 was sort of benevolent ignorance. And sometimes they'd look at me like, "You're what? What's that?" But it was after 1979 that hostility really started to seep into the reactions. And so when I first started working as a lawyer, you know, 2 months into my role as a new associate corporate lawyer in San Francisco, one of the partners sat me down and said, "So why are Muslims more violent than other kinds of people?" And you know, there I was in my new suit, in my new pumps, and looking really nonviolent and friendly. And this was, again, before 9/11. So these things had been going along for a while. And 9/11 was, of course, scary. And my mother was visiting at the time because I had sprained one hand and burned the other one, and she was helping me. And after 9/11, I thought, how am I going to get her home again? Because I was worried about her going on a plane by herself. You know, she has an Indian accent, and you know, I didn't want my dad to drive up alone and to pick her up. And I you know, it was just something maybe you don't think about, but I was just afraid. I was afraid that these people who looked foreign and sounded foreign would be in danger somehow. So, but I really saw it overall as kind of a really tragic event that was another event in the progression of how Islam has been continually in the media. Yeah. So, and I even before 9/11, I also was going to my kids' schools and talking about Ramadan to them. So.
That's, yeah, I have a sense that we missed a sitcom opportunity here of a Muslim Valley Girl.
I'm not going to do my accent.
Mohammed?
You know, it's for me, starting before 9/11, and, you know, my parents and I, we immigrated to the U.S., and one thing was around assimilation. And, you know, let's fit in before 9/11, let's all be part of it. And it was interesting, you know, part of the conversation was then that veil thing. So my mother is here today right now, and she actually does wear the complete veil thing. And being around that always allowed me to realize how putting the religion in perspective. She got called ninja. She got called all those things throughout her life. And just watching that from as a little kid, I was able to calibrate it. And at times I distanced myself. At other times this is what America is all about. And, you know, so my North Star became my mother, who happens to be here today as well. And she is wearing that veil thing. And you can ask her about it, not me. But, you know, after 9/11, it was, you know, in my day job, I work in education, in public, supporting public education. And the responsibility was, for me, clear that if what people are saying is not true, there's a responsibility for Muslims to set the record straight, not only by their actions, but also what does the religion actually say. So for the last 10 years now, I've been working on a couple of campaigns around the country around Muslims for Peace, Muslims for Loyalty, and Muslims for Life, which really brings about this question of, do Muslims have to be loyal to their country? Answering some of those basic questions based on religious content, not just opinion, and really going through that exercise. And just this past year, on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community came together to collect 10,000 bags of blood around the country as a response. So I chose to channel my energy in those directions. I think we're very lucky to live in California, more northern than southern, but where I think California is a community that really is much more understanding and knows the difference between some minority of extremists who've hijacked a religion versus what Islam truly is. But if you go around the country, that's not the case. And really, really educating the community has been my quote-unquote jihad. It's not broccoli. I won't take that on, but that's at least how I think about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Silicon Valley, since you segued into that. Do you really think it's different, let's say the Bay Area? Is it really different here? It's my perception that it is. When I always kid people, I, you know, came to Stanford and never went back. And one of the reasons, okay, the weather is all right. But the main reason was I came from a very black and white part of the community and lived next door to a minister who was fired by his congregation for marrying a mixed-race couple. And I found this place just extraordinarily different and refreshing. Do you perceive it the same way, or is that me coming in? And, who would like to? You've all spent some time.
I can take a shot at that. I travel a lot for various reasons, and with a name like Muhammad, it can't be racially profiled because it's just everyone has the name Muhammad in their name. So I've never been, I don't think I've been profiled, but if you go to different parts of the country, I do notice a difference. I mean, I was just last week, I was at the Houston airport, and I got more funny looks than I've ever gotten in California, the Bay Area. So there's always there's always a small group of folks who would respond in a funny way. But for the most part, I think been very lucky. And what I love about Silicon Valley is it's the intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. I've had to explain myself more than anywhere else in the country as well, where people do ask the question of, so if it's not true, tell me why. And that rigor has made me understand the religion better as well as a result of it.
Rania, what's been your experience? Are you have you lived anyplace else? I know you go back. We were talking earlier. Yeah. I know you go back and forth to Cairo a lot.
Yeah. I mean, for the most, I was born here. I spent most of my life here, except maybe my elementary school years. I lived in Oregon. But I have been in the Bay Area. I have traveled, you know, through the U.S. and different countries. And I do believe it's different here. We definitely have a much more diverse community. You know, we have, there's a large Muslim community, you know, Asian, Indian. I mean, and even in my own community, our school is very diverse. When I was a kid, I went to St. Andrew's School here in Saratoga, and me and my brother were the only Muslims in the entire school. We were the only ones fasting. And it was very, it was a very foreign thing to people to see kids abstaining from food and drink. You know, they try to taunt us with food, and it's okay to eat. We're not going to say anything. which is ironic because that wasn't the point of it. But now, I mean, the community has become so much more diverse. My children have four or five other Muslims in their own classrooms, you know, fasting along with them, which is a completely different time than when I was a kid. And not just that, even, I mean, even when I interviewed with Senator Ahlquist, being Muslim actually worked to my advantage, surprisingly. Senator Ahlquist's district is Senate District 13. Her district includes the cities of Santa Clara, Sunnyvale, Mountain View, San Jose, and Gilroy. And Santa Clara has one of the largest community centers for Muslims here and one of the largest populations as well. So this was something, you know, that she liked and admired, and I was able to kind of maintain that connection with Muslims in the community. Yes. So,
thank you. Symbol, I assume you've been traveling around with the book. Do you perceive differences in different regions?
You know, I haven't really lived in another place except for L.A. And I have to say, actually, I did, in law school, I was a clerk in summer associate at a law firm in Newport Beach. And that seemed like a different culture to me. And I felt a lot of pressure to be blonde. So
just going back to my Valley Girl point, okay?
So, but you know, the reason I'm here is because it's amazing to me that I want my kids to learn from all different kinds of people, and that's what we have in this area. It's just amazing that there are so many kids from so many different kinds of backgrounds, ethnic, religious, socioeconomic, and it's really important for me that they learn from each other and they learn to respect people no matter what their background is. And that's not, I don't think it's the case in all parts of the country. You know, I have a friend who's Chinese American, and she's married to a Jewish man, and they live in North Carolina. And, you know, they've had a different experience, and they're always, you know, looking for diversity and not really finding much. So I feel very privileged to live here.
Well, that's good. I'm pleased to hear that about my adopted home. Well, you and I, and well, all of us were talking earlier about how sometimes it's difficult to discuss being Muslim and the current affairs, issues around Islamic politics and so on. Could you talk a little bit about that? How is it harder than other things that we...
Okay. Well, you know, because I was a kid before the Iranian Revolution, I feel like I've seen... There's been such a change in the way Islam has been perceived in the last few decades in this country. And I've really been able to see how it's progressed or not progressed or changed. And, when my dad came, he never talked about religion. In fact, I often say, you know, my dad always told me, never talk about religion, politics, or other people's children. And, you know, I mean, I can't believe sometimes I've written a book on religion. but you know, this was something that was, when I was younger, you know, we kept it to ourselves. We didn't talk about being Muslim unless it came up. I mean, one day in high school when I was fasting, I you know, it's no food or water till sunset, and I got to school only to find that I had to run the mile for the presidential physical fitness test. So there were, you know, those, anyway. So, but But when I was a kid, I feel like there weren't quite so many obstacles because people just didn't know really anything. Mm-hmm. And so I could just tell them. It's like, oh, here's why I fast. Now, unfortunately, you have to unpack a lot of stereotypes. And so there are very concrete obstacles that I see in talking about Islam and Muslims. And one is the fact that most Americans didn't have an education on world religions. You know, most of the time in schools, we weren't taught world religions. And in bookstores, there weren't really any books on Islam. And even when there were dry textbooks that were put into, you know, classified along with the Eastern religions like Taoism and Buddhism, you know, these things that it really doesn't have anything in common with. It's a Judeo-Christian religion. So, you know, you have kind of this absence of knowledge on Islam. And against that background, you have these very real incidents of violence. The Iranian Revolution was really the first impression that people had of Islam. And here they saw this bearded, turbaned guy who was really angry. We didn't know what he was talking about, but he was clearly really angry. And that was kind of the basis with which we started. So that's all. So in a way, Muslims are kind of trying to play catch-up all the time, like trying to, you know, the first impression was a bad one, and it's hard to get rid of that kind of impression. So one is the lack of education that I think is a problem, and the other one is that the very, you know, real incidents that are happening. Another is, you know, we're going to maybe talk about the media later, but the media does focus on things that are newsworthy, and very often those are violent incidents. You know, very often it doesn't focus on the positive stuff that's happening in the world. It focuses on the violence and the strife. So, those are a few.
Why don't we just, first of all, did either of you have anything you'd like to say about the difficulty of bringing up, or do you still really try not to talk about your religion unless someone asks? How do you approach that, Rania?
Definitely I agree with Simbol that religion just tends to be a very sensitive topic for anybody. But nevertheless, is definitely a discussion that needs to be had so that people are informed and well-educated about Islam and other religions. If I find an opportunity, I will bring it up. Often, at work, people will ask me questions about Islam and I'm very comfortable talking about it, answering questions. I think it's important to do that and be willing to talk about it. How else will people learn? I also encourage taking action as well, just setting a good example and, kind of walking the talk is always important. So,
For me, it's, I think, the opposite. I think speaking on religion and going into the issues allows for me to sometimes have the most richest conversations with people I just met and old friends. And when you really go into it and you ask the hard questions, mm-hmm. particularly people of other faiths, and if you're really trying to have a conversation of understanding, not trying to convert the other person or trying to say which one's better, but really going at what's the root of this, why do most religions have these basic principles? And what we're the understanding that most of the time we come to that, the Christianity, Judaism, Islam, they're more alike than they are different. Humans have done many things to try to change that. But if you look at the root of them, they're so much alike. And for me, it's I welcome the conversation because it brings me closer to people than it distances me from them.
Let's see. Simbol, you brought up the media, and I have to say, as a lifetime journalist, I'm reading Simbol's book, and I'm going through it, and all she talks about is, negative about the media, and another page, and another page, but I keep going, and, a lot of them are good points. I am curious, though, you seem to paint the media with one brush. And I wonder if you see differences at all. I mean, I think one of the things, sort of being put in the same category as Rush Limbaugh and Andy Rooney, it just bothered me a little bit.
It would bother me too.
Yeah. Could you talk about, you know, the nuances?
Yeah. So first of all, the media is in the subtitle of the book, right? So
right.
It's called The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing. And I have to tell you, first of all, that the publisher is responsible for the title and the cover of my book. I had nothing to do with it. In fact, at first it was only going to be called The Muslim Next Door. And then the reaction they got to that title was, The Muslim Next Door? And they said, oh, it's too scary. It's just too scary a title. And then later they said, oh, yeah, I know. We can put a friendly person on the cover, and we can have this subtitle that will, you know, take away from the terrifying aspect of The Muslim Next Door. So they put in the Quran, the media, and that veil thing. There's actually only one chapter on the media. And so, for example, I have an example about Andy Rooney. That's in there not so much to talk about the media, but to talk about the kinds of things that people say about the Quran. It's in the Quran chapter. Now, the chapter on the media is not there to be critical of the media. It's there
I'm trying not to take it personally.
I don't think I feel very critical of the media. I mean, that's not why I wrote it. I wrote it as an explanation for why some of these misconceptions persist. And, of course, you know, there are journalists who say bigoted things on the air, and there are journalists who are fair and thoughtful and just and try to do their best. And when I talk about the media, I don't talk about these individuals. What I'm talking about is the methodology that the media as an institution uses in framing Islam-related issues. So there is a very specific set of principles that media uses when it frames the issues that have to do with Islam. And some of them, the biggest one probably, is how when a Muslim commits a crime, it's usually portrayed as a function of his or her religion. So, for example, a few years ago, there's a Muslim American TV producer who was arrested for murdering his wife. Now, the media didn't say, and this is from NPR to Fox, none of the media said, oh, what a tragic case of domestic violence. They said, he was Muslim. Maybe this was an honor killing. Let's look in the Quran to see if the Quran supports any kind of event like this. Now, you know, three women on average a day are murdered by their husbands or boyfriends in this country. We don't look into the religion of all these people. So that's just one example, but it's a very typical example. This is something that that is periodically used. So, you know, when Major Nidal Hassan, for the Fort Hood shooting, when that was on the air, again, NPR to Fox, the first thing they said was, he's a devout Muslim, he prays five times a day, he goes to the mosque on Fridays. By contrast, when you had the murder of George Tiller, who was the abortion doctor, and Scott Roeder was on trial for him, the media ignored all of his connections to religion. They ignored his connections to the Christian Armies of God, to the Christian Identity Movement. They didn't interview his wife, who was talking about how, you know, he felt strongly from a religious point of view. It was distanced. Mm-hmm. So it really is a double standard that's in the media. And you know, there are all sorts of other specific ways to, you know, the media tends to ignore the Muslim victims and focus on the Muslim criminals. For example, very few, you know, we hear about Muslim women who are oppressed all the time, but very few people I run into actually know that six Muslim women have been heads of state of Muslim countries in the last few decades, either presidents or prime ministers, which means that they not only were supported by their populations, you know, they had the resources and the intelligence to get there.
And that would be six more than in this country.
So I don't want you to feel insulted.
I was joking, really. I didn't take it personally.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
I think there's another category of the media which is just misinformed. And there hasn't been a clear and concerted effort But, you know, I'd always hear, where are the moderate Muslims? Will they please stand up? And where are they from mm-hmm. media? And like, you know, you can throw a press conference and say, I'm a moderate Muslim, and you'll, maybe Barbara will show up because she's my friend. But beyond that, you know, it just doesn't sell. But really coming together and being organized and communicating what is Islam and putting out an effort, because there's some misinformed. There's a counter effort towards that as well. And blaming the religion for doing that. I do think that the Muslim community does need to take some responsibility for better informing the media and what is Islam and really going deeper into that, into those issues. And secondly, I think there's a responsibility of informing the Muslim community itself on separating, and particularly the youth, on what is true Islam. And how do you separate that? Because there are some extremists out there who have a propaganda machine as well. So the moderate Muslims which is probably the vast majority of the community, either they're not jumping up and down talking about true Islam to the media, as well as to Muslims and others saying, here's what true Islam really is, and you need to understand that. And I think that was a miss before September 11th. Now, a lot of organizations have come together, like CARE, like the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community, like MPAC, who are really communicating those messages throughout the country, which I think has had a very positive impact as well.
Great. Do you have a perception of the media? Do you feel as though... you are unfairly portrayed at times?
I would have to say, I think Sumbul and Muhammad kind of covered it okay. as far as, you know, how Muslims are portrayed in the media. But I would like to say San Jose Mercury News, I think, has published some great articles, positive articles. I did notice, you know, there's always excerpts about Ramadan and open houses. And even just the good work that Muslims do in our community. So
I did
I would
not
like
put
to,
her up.
I know.
To this.
I would like to say San Jose Mercury News. I think locally, I think does a good job.
That's very sweet. And yesterday we published an op-ed from Muhammad about Sharia. If you haven't seen that, mercurynews.com/opinion. Look up what he had to say. Thank you. That's very kind of you. We do try every now and then, especially since reading the book, I see something and I think, could have couched that a little differently in the paper, but we do try locally. I have a question here that I actually never thought of from the audience. It is, do you as an American Muslim experience any of the Sunni Shiite conflict?
Oh, I can start with that mm-hmm. because, well, because I have to say, my husband's family is Sunni, Shia, and Ismaili. So, all of them. So, his great-grandfather, one of those, had three sons, and he was Ismaili, and one of his sons became Sunni, and one became Shia. So, we have extended family who is... On my husband's father's side, who is Sunni, Shia, and Ismaili, and his mother's side is Christian, so we have Christian relatives on his mother's side, and then some of my relatives are atheist and Christian. So anyway, so we're we have a bunch of people. You know, I grew up going to a mosque with both Sunni and Shia, and this is not just a function of being an American. My father grew up in India, and he grew up in a mosque where there were both Sunni and Shia. And in fact, I have a friend who was an adult before she asked her father, are we Sunni or are we Shia? Because really, there's not that much difference. And I happen to be Sunni, but I go to a Shia Islamic center. So there are very few differences. And I think, unfortunately, since the invasion of Iraq, this term sectarian violence has been so widespread, and it's been a catch-all phrase for something that might have nothing to do with sectarian violence. It might be resource wars, thuggery, mm-hmm. power plays, but that's just a very easy way to characterize it. So historically speaking also, there has not been the kind of strife, I mean, there are always incidents, but there's not been the kind of strife between Sunni and Shia that there has been in, say, like between Protestant and Catholicism. It hasn't been that huge.
Hmm. But, you know, I agree with that. I think the challenges I've seen in many, quote-unquote, Muslim countries is something that freely enjoy in America, and that does not exist, and that's freedom of religion. And I think that that's a quality that these, you know, more of these so-called Muslim countries, if they have that, not just between Sunnis and Shias, but the oppression you take Saudi Arabia, you take Pakistan, you take Bangladesh, you take Indonesia, some of these so-called Muslim countries, and how even within there isn't freedom of religion and there isn't freedom. And that, again, is not an Islamic concept. That's what that country does within their borders and how they govern. There's nowhere in Islam where it says, you know, Christians have to follow Muslim rule in Saudi Arabia. So I think while it's not true, I think these countries that magnify that problem and continue to do so. So I always say that the most Muslim country I know is the United States of America, because we have freedom of religion, freedom of practice, freedom of speech. I mean, those are truly Islamic concepts that are being practiced here.
You should have written that in the op-ed. We'd have gotten even more interesting letters.
I think also, just to add one thing, in Iraq, I was reading that in Iraq, you know, Sunni-Shia marriages were so commonplace that nobody remarked on them. But now, because of the invasion, it's become very difficult because Iraq has splintered into Sunni areas and Shia areas. And so it's been hard for those couples who have both Sunni and Shia in their families. Like, where do you live? You live in the Shia place or the... So.
There's another interesting question here. Is there a stereotype you think that even educated, progressive Bay Area people have of Muslims that you would like to debunk for us tonight? And I'm
That's
not
really
going
nice.
To take anything personally, Seth. Can you think of anything?
I can throw out a few and they can answer them.
Okay, yeah,
how's that?
I have a few too.
I think that the biggest one I hear about all the time is in Islam, women are women are oppressed.
Yep,
and they're constituted as second class citizens. They're, you know, what about the women? You know, I can tell, you know, if you look at my mother and she's sitting next to my father, is she really oppressed? I feel sorry for my dad. So it's just not the case. But I think that's the one issue where I can see how people are led to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel it's true, but I'm not the right person to answer that either. So I'll throw the question out to you you guys. We're the smarter people on the panel, obviously.
No, that's the one I was going to say as well. But, because, you know, and there are so many misconceptions surrounding it. Like one of the guys who I was speaking to somebody who said, well, you know, I'm all about liberty and women's rights. This is a man. He said, I'm all about women's rights, so I really think the headscarf is a bad idea. And I said, well, you know, the Prime Minister of Pakistan wore a headscarf, and she was Prime Minister. I don't know if she was oppressed. But I think that is definitely a big one. And it was amazing to me, again, when I was working as a lawyer, I had a partner say to me, well, Islam is sexist. You don't think Islam is sexist? I was like, I'm a corporate lawyer working with you. But this is definitely something, and I don't know if he thought that I had just broken my chains somehow, but you know, I'll tell you, when I was growing up, all the Muslim women I knew, Muslim girls growing up, were just pestered by their parents to do well in school and get well-paying jobs. You know, none of them were taught, you don't have to get an education because you're going to be married off and be dependent on your husband. None of them. I mean, we were all nagged to death to do well in school. And my dad was really disappointed when I went to law school. He wanted me to be a physician. So it was, you know. But I think that's...
I have to second that one.
I think a lot of what people assume is oppression of women in Islam is actually cultural norms. Muslim countries are patriarchal countries. Many of them are developing countries, and in any developing countries, whether they're Muslim or not, women suffer disproportionately. So, sorry.
No, that's okay. I just had to second the stress on doing well in school and striving for education. My father actually told me I couldn't get married until I got a PhD.
That sounds like oppression to me.
I negotiated the MBA, and my sister got the PhD, so he's happy. But yeah, I think that is probably the biggest stereotype, is that women, Muslim women, are forced to cover, or they're oppressed, their marriages are arranged, and that's definitely not the case at all. You know, covering is a choice that women make. They're not forced to do it. And if anything, I feel Islam really gives I feel respected as a Muslim woman, you know, within my community and, you know, amongst my family and fellow Muslims. So.
That's neat. I agree. That is, as soon as Muhammad said it, it does jump out, because you see the pictures of the burqas and so on. And yet I knew Rabia, Muhammad's yeah. wife, long before I met him, and I had no idea she was Muslim. You know, works for... county worked at that time for county supervisor, or city council member, rather. This is really an aside, but I have to ask Sumbul something about the book. You referred a number of times to a man who came to the party at the end of Ramadan, the celebration. Is it Eid?
Eid.
Who was not Muslim and was just thoroughly obnoxious, kept making comments about Muslims being violent and so on. And he was sort of a recurring theme through one chapter. Do you remember who I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. It was one anecdote. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sort of kept.
So my question to you is, did you send him a copy of the book?
You know, I can't talk about anybody that I talk about in the book.
Because I was going to offer, if you haven't, I'd send him one for you.
I think he knows about it.
Okay.
In fact, one of my former colleagues at my first law firm was saying, we were trying to figure out who all these partners were who said these things to you. I said, I can't tell you. That would not be nice.
I just kind of pictured this character seeing the book. Here in the Valley, we have, a couple of you have mentioned the Muslim Community Association, the huge mosque in Santa Clara, which I actually visited for the first time a few weeks ago with my husband for a Silicon Valley Reads event. I can't believe it was my first time there. Does having that kind of large organization here make a difference in the Muslim community? Do you all engage with that in one way or another?
I guess I'll begin. Well, I actually, growing up here, I remember when the Muslim Community Association in Santa Clara was just the small building on Catherine Street, Mr. Janur, and I used to attend Arabic school there on Sunday and learn religion as well. So it was a place to come together and kind of get that sense of community and identity. And it's now much larger, as you know, with the building on Scott Boulevard that houses a couple schools and provides services, legal services, youth groups, and it did play a significant role in my life growing up, and it's a place for us to perform congregational prayers, and I take my children there as well, so it's just as important as a church or a synagogue. Or a temple for most people here. So,
yeah, there's that mosque, and there's many others in the valley as well. I participate in one in Milpitas, but I think one of the challenges, like in the when you look at Christian churches and the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, right or wrong, is much more organized with central leadership. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges that I think in some of the mosques that we have is, where is the central leadership that kind of has a hierarchical structure? Again, right or wrong, not theologically, but organizationally, it allows for a better organized community. And the one I belong to happens to have central leadership. So it allows for one person centrally to say, this is right, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think There's many mosques in the valley that just like churches, just like synagogues. And what I've noticed is, and what I wish there was more of, I know Rabbi Melanie Aaron in Los Gatos, you know, great community leader, has hosted a lot of interfaith dialogues. I know in our mosque she's come. We've hosted lots of interfaith dialogues. I know in the Catholic Church, we've really come together, and where people come together, you know, as a community. I think all religions win, and that's what I've noticed. And again, going back to praising the valley, I think it's much more amenable to that.
Thank you. Did you have? You don't have to. I just thought you were going to say something.
Oh, no, well, you know, I think I grew up with a different model because, you know, as I say in the book, you know, the mosque I attended was a 2-car garage. This was just a bunch of my parents' friends who were getting together and teaching the kids how to read Arabic. But I think, you know, one of the things that people often don't realize, and even often Muslims don't realize, is that Islam, there's no one true Islam. You know, Islam is a range of beliefs and practices. And, you know, when I was getting my degree, one of the things that I remember my Islamic law professor saying, Islam is more fluid than people think. And it made a big impression on me. He wasn't, none of my professors when I was doing my degree in Islamic law were actually Muslim. But he was this wonderful Christian Lebanese professor. And he said, Islam is more fluid than people think. And I think Muslims don't even realize that there are so many different variations in Islam that are equally valid. You know, Islam, the innate methodology in Islam and Islamic law allows for differences in interpretation. There are many schools of law or schools of thought, you could call them, in Islamic law. They all recognize each other as equally valid, even when they contradict each other. So there's not one, you know, oftentimes in this country we think of Islam as very rigid and fixed and medieval, and it really isn't. So I think that's sometimes a challenge when it comes to having a mosque, like, because it's like you have Baptists and Lutherans and Pentecostalists and Catholics all in one place. And so sometimes that can be a challenge. And then Muslims are also the most the most diverse, ethnically diverse, religious community in the States. So, which is great, but we also have challenges of cultural differences and language differences. So I think that's our challenge right now as a Muslim community, and when it comes to mosques and gathering places and where we go to have our community.
We've actually had two people submit the same question, which is, how did the Quran get written, when, and by whom? Somebody like, I know you talk about that in the book. I don't know if you would
okay.
Like...
So I'll tell you what Muslims believe, because I think often to understand religion, you really have to read about it as if you believe it. You don't have to believe it, but you have to learn about it as if you believe it, because religion is belief, right? If you are very skeptical, then it's hard to understand it. So Muhammad, who was the prophet of Islam, was born around the year 570 in what is now Mecca in Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula. When he was 40 years old, he, you know, if you don't want to think of him as a prophet, you can think of him as a social reformer, because he was very much concerned with injustice and the social situation in his community. So he used to go up and meditate. When he was 40 years old, he was meditating in the dark at night in a cave, and he heard a voice tell him to read or recite. Understandably, he was pretty scared. And three times the voice told him to read or recite. And finally he said, what should I read? And the voice recited a few lines to him, which were the first words to become what would eventually become the Quran. So Muslims believe that this voice was the angel Gabriel bringing God's words to Muhammad. And I have a friend who's from Mexico and Catholic, and she kept saying, the same angel Gabriel? Yes, because Islam accepts the Judeo-Christian tradition as part of itself. So Muslims believe that God spoke the words to the angel Gabriel, who recited them to Muhammad. Muhammad recited them out loud, and his followers wrote them down. Within 20 years of Muhammad's death, these words were compiled into what we know as the Quran. So since its compilation, actually, the words of the Quran have not changed, because Muslims have been very resistant to translating it or changing any part of it, afraid that someone might, who has their own agenda, would change it to fit their own personal beliefs or agenda. So that's how it became.
Thank you. Rania, here's a good question for you, and perhaps others. I'm not sure where you've traveled, but it is, when visiting your respective countries of cultural or religious origin, do you ever experience negative treatment for being American? And I know Rania goes to Cairo occasionally. So.
Yes. Let's see. I've never had a negative reaction, but I do get the reaction that, oh, you're Egyptian, but you're different. You know, it's obvious that you haven't been raised here. when I go there, I feel like I'm in limbo. You know, I feel like I'm with people who are, you know, fellow Egyptians, and obviously I look like them, you know, so it's great to go back there. But at the same time, I was born and raised here, so I do feel more American than Egyptian, and they do sense that. But I do speak Arabic, and, you know, I am able to go and, you know, live there and get along and, you know, be able to make my way around. But definitely because I was born and raised here, there is a bit of a challenge when I do go back and visit.
Up until a few years ago, forget those countries, I got a negative reaction to being American when I went to England. So
that's very true.
but being from Pakistan, I mean, the last time I went was around 2005 when there was the massive earthquakes there in the Kashmir region, and going to a country where there's a lot of internal challenges. I mean, there are certain, you know, the community that I belong to is declared non-Muslims in a Muslim country. So there's a lot of internal challenges. And then you go down the street and you see pictures of Osama bin Laden like this on the back of trucks. And you're like, I mean, you're shocked as an American. But, you know, that's when the positive of that is that's when America was at its finest there. When the Chinook helicopters dropped bulldozers to open up roads on both sides very quickly. I mean, you saw their approval ratings go up. Mm-hmm. But as an individual coming from America, people just questioned everything. They question your ability to be Muslim in America. I mean, how can you practice Islam there? And, you know, some of the before I went there, I'd always hear these stories. Well, you know, in the motherland, we prayed five times a day, right on the dot, and we did all. You know, you Americans, you know, you guys have eased up a little bit, right, on your interpretation. But what I realized is people are people in every country, and they've eased up a little bit there too. These fond memories. But in answer to your question, I think. Americans do get a bad rap in a lot of these countries, but I think it's cultural, and I think it's not based on religion. And you know, the only symbol I agree with most of your interpretation, but I would say Islam is pretty consistent. It's people's interpretation, which just comes at it from 50 different angles and how they tackle some of the issues. It varies. You know, there's 72 different sects, just like in every religion. But the great thing is that the source document, being the Quran, the way she described it, hasn't changed in that. Mm-hmm. So you can always go back to the source document and come up with your own interpretation of what it is.
It always seems to be the challenge with the Bible. You have so many different Christian groups reading the same book and coming to entirely different conclusions. And
sometimes I read your op-eds and come to different conclusions as well.
They certainly do, yes. And sometimes they read yours. a question here. How would you define the term progressive Muslim? Is there such a thing as a progressive Muslim? Are you all progressive Muslims?
Well, you know, I thought of myself as traditional when I was growing up because I practiced Islam the same way that my parents do and the same way that my grandparents did in India. So I always thought of myself as traditional. But, you know, traditional means different things to different people. I mean, for someone, you know, maybe in Cairo or actually even, say, a small village is very different sometimes from a diverse city. So I think that's a difficult question.
Yeah.
I think I always thought of Islam as progressive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people, Islam and Muhammad were feminist in the 7th century. You know, they gave women more rights than any other women had in the rest of the world. And in fact, the Quran and Muhammad gave women more rights than English women would have for another 1,000 years. So, you know, obviously we're not there anymore. You know, we have issues that we need to address. and I think some of those rights are being ignored now. But for me, it's really interesting because I never thought of myself as a modernist or progressive Muslim. I just thought this is how Islam is. But
I agree with that. But you know, one of the things that in my journey, working on this Muslims for Loyalty, Muslims for Peace campaigns, we really went back to, you know, where are the moderate Muslims? A question that people mm-hmm. kept asking, and so we struggled with it. So what does a moderate Muslim look like to me? And you know, we came up with a top 10 list. You know, and what is your interpretation on certain questions? And two of the questions, so what does a moderate Muslim look like or a progressive Muslim look like? And I'll throw out two of the 10. One is Islam's interpretation of who should you be loyal to, the question of loyalty. Should you be loyal to your country of residence or to Islam and kill the infidel, if you will, and or to another country, you're just here to kind of hang out, and that question keeps coming up. And based on our research, you look at the Quran as a source document saying, you know, Islam promotes loyalty to your country of residence. So that's one interpretation, I think. And the other one I've looked at is this whole idea of kill the infidels, you know. So can you kill people of other religions? And according to my interpretation, if you look at the source document in the Quran, it says, you know, there's no coercion in religion. So based on just that one line, my interpretation is, you know, you cannot kill anyone based on any of those things. And we came up with a lot more things, you know, punishment for apostasy. There's a list of things that you can look at, but that's very doctrinal and, you know, inside baseball, if you will. But I absolutely agree with Sumbul on the surface, when you look at most Muslims, and you've got to ask them what their interpretations are on certain things. I think you can ask certain questions and get clarity. Where do you come out on that? And some people may come out in different places. I believe, for instance, that there's a separation of mosque and state in Islam. Some may not. So going down those, you know, what is jihad? What is the interpretation of jihad? I mean, so you can go down a list of questions and really, really determine for yourself.
But, you know, I think this is not a matter of individual interpretation, though. I mean, those questions, when it comes to religion, it's really a numbers game because you look at what the majority of people say or where the consensus is, right? So coming with a law background and, you know, my degree is in Islam, but it's with an emphasis on law, right, and on sort of the legalistic aspects of Islam. And in Islamic law, there's definitely a methodology for interpreting some of these things. And so it wasn't so much every man for his own, and you can look at the Quran and interpret it however you want. I mean, you've all heard of fatwas, for example. So a fatwa is a legal opinion by a recognized Islamic scholar. So I can't, for example, go out and give a fatwa on Alzheimer's disease because I don't know anything about it. And I'm not a, you know, recognized medical scholar. So, you know, in Islamic law, to be able to give a fatwa, you have to follow a certain methodology. You have to look at certain sources. You have to justify how you've come to this conclusion, and then you have a conclusion. And even then, it's not binding. Like, you don't have to follow it, but it's an opinion by a legal scholar. If that opinion is agreed with by a lot of legal scholars, then it might become a consensus. And if it's the consensus, then it becomes kind of one of the mainstream guidelines of Islamic law. So like when it comes to jihad, you know, there are certain, there's a certain consensus on how you interpret that. And yes, there are variations, but there are parameters also. There are parameters that within which all these interpretations fall. There's, and some, for example, all Islamic scholars said you cannot kill civilians. You cannot arbitrarily destroy property. You cannot commit terrorism, which is the clandestine use of force. You cannot kill people taking refuge in churches and mosques and sanctuaries like that. So,
somewhat, I think it comes back down to who you follow as an individual. It's, you don't follow, you follow certain Sunni Shias, and there's certain, so the lack of leadership, and that's where it comes down to. There's arguments can be made on two sides of every issue, but I think who you follow, and that's where I think the issue of centralized leadership matters significantly.
I think we have time for just one more question. Actually, they'll probably rush us. I thought it'd be nice to end looking forward. You all have children, some a little younger than others. Mohammed has very young twins, who I believe are sleeping the night now. Right? Yes.
Big accomplishment.
Will you raise your children differently in this world than you were raised? Are there things you will do differently with your kids that your parents did not do with you because of the controversy around Islam at this time? Rania?
You know, I like the way my parents raised me, and I would like to, I would love to raise my children the same way. I think my children are second generation, obviously, so my fear is that they're not going to get as much of the culture and religion that I got, but, you know, I think that one of the things that I have noticed two things that I've noticed that I've done differently for my children. And my children, I have three children, 13, 10, and almost 5. She's counting down the weeks. She'll be 5 in March. But two of the things that I am doing differently is that I am engaging more in their communities at schools. I mentioned that already. You know, I had joined the PTA. And I found that's encouraged them as well to take part in their student councils. And that's something I never would have dreamed of doing when I was a kid. So I'm happy to see that. I am happy to see that they also want to engage in the community, because I think it's important to make contributions to our society here. And then the second thing that I am doing differently is I want them to really appreciate and love who they are, and accept themselves as Muslims and have a strong sense of identity. And I know that when we were celebrating Eid, you know, there weren't many Muslims around when I was a kid. I've tried to make it you know, special for them. You know, Eid in Egypt is like Christmas here, where there's lights and traditions that go on, and that's something that I make an effort, much more of an effort, with my children, where we decorate and make cookies, and something that I want them to enjoy. So,
thank you. Mohammed, would you like to?
With my parents in the room, that'd be a little difficult to answer.
Yeah. you can take a pass on that if you'd like.
But since my kids are only 6 months old, you know, I've got an idealist path, whereas Ronnie, you may not be as idealist. But I hope to raise them with much more exposure to not only the religion but the community, much more than I had. I'm currently on the board of the Hispanic Foundation, because I think I grew up Hispanic more than I did Muslim here, because there were no other Muslims when I was growing up, or a small amount. So making sure they get much more exposure. And secondly, making sure they have access to source information so they can make their own decisions better. Now, nowadays, you know, with Google and everything, you can get to the root of an answer very quickly and making sure that they have that exposure.
Oh, that's neat. Simple.
You know, like Ronnie, I like the way my parents raised me. I really didn't feel any conflict between my various identities growing up in this country. It never occurred to me that there might be a conflict between being Muslim and American. It never even occurred to me. So, certainly never thought of my religion as something that would ever stop me from doing what I wanted to do in my life. And that's how I'm raising my kids. I think the big difference is that, unfortunately, they have to be more prepared to answer some of these questions than I had to answer. Because, you know, words like jihad and sharia and, you know, fiqh and all these other things, you know, I never heard when I was growing up as a child. You know, I didn't know this word sharia until I got my degree in Islamic law. So it's not something that comes up. You know, most of us, me and my friends anyway, you know, we were taught the basic stuff. You know, you pray, you fast, you be a good person, you don't lie, you don't cheat, even though the guy on the video cheated on his test. You know, all those things that I think universal values that a lot of us grow up with. We weren't taught these specifics of 1,000-year-old Islamic law, but unfortunately now that they've been redefined in the public discourse, my kids are going to have to learn how to deal with it.
Well, thank you all. I've certainly enjoyed this, and I hope all of you enjoyed this evening's program. We look forward to seeing you at future Silicon Valley Reads events. There are a lot of them. That website has just a wealth of information. Again, we'd like to thank our panelists, Sumbul Alikarmali, Mohammed Chowdhury, and Rania Mohsen. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a delight to meet you.
Thank you very much.